Now, here's a flavour of a sort of memoir from a colleague of hers, as it were, a compatriot, Lord Chris Patten of Barnes, he who presided as the late British governor over the handback of Hong Kong 20 years ago this year to China. He's about to join me as he's visiting Australia. A Chinese anthem, he wrote, written in 1100 BC, warned against three foolish things. First, deep sleep in an unknown house. Second, setting out to sea in a borrowed junk. Third, not to lag behind when the elephant approaches a new bridge. To which Chris Patten has added a fourth foolish thing, writing a political autobiography, particularly if it's a memoir of the conventional sort. So he hasn't done so. But his latest work, First Confession, canvasses the extraordinary array of experiences of his very engaged public life over several decades as a rising star and influential minister with the Conservative Party, though one of the wets, that is a moderate, as an EU commissioner, as chair of the BBC, and currently Chancellor of Oxford University. But he also chooses to focus on his the relationship between politics and identity, such a topic of the moment. And I'll ask him why. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thanks very much.
Look, the relationship between politics and identity, you say, has begun to intrigue you completely. When did this happen? I wonder if it was reflecting on all that you've done in your career for this book, or is it the times we're living through that provoked you?
It's both, really. I mean, I'm just over 70. I grew up in a period which was dominated by ideological politics, West versus East, communism versus capitalism, and so on. By the end of the 1980s, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, people assumed that was over and that liberal with a small L economics and politics had won the day, democracy, rule of law, and so on. But we found ourselves in the last few years, and 9/11 was perhaps the most savage example of that. We found ourselves dealing with the politics of identity, or as a French Lebanese Christian Arab writer says, the panthers of identity politics. And when I thought about it, it seemed to me that it was a subject in which I had a particular interest, both because of my own background, though a middle-class scholarship boy, Irish immigrant, and so on, which was complicated, not very straightforward. And secondly, because some of the subjects I've dealt with in Northern Ireland, in the Balkans, in Hong Kong, have involved arguments about identity, which I think are much too crude and simplistic. So when I hear President Trump, for example, talking about making America great again, when I see him refusing to criticize those who walk around at white supremacist rallies with banners saying blood and soil, I think of all the examples in the 20s and 30s when identity politics savaged democracy and savaged civilized societies.
Yes, you do. What is interesting is you tap into or recognise the strong sense of your own identity that you brought to politics and you continue to bring to your public life. You're very you're very centred, aren't you, in your own background? Do you think that helps?
Yeah, I do. I mean, centred in the sense that I've always reckoned that given the complexities of my own identity, it was ridiculous to talk as though identity was something very simple that you could describe simply in terms of language or race or ethnicity. I'm a complicated person, and most of us are complicated. So to talk about what some people say is the first question in political science, who are we, as though you could answer that question in a very simple way, is, I think, absolute nonsense. And I think most people would feel that in their own experience.
Yes, but Ferdinand Mount, who wrote a very interesting review of your book and also Kenneth Clark's book in the New York Review, says that you say it is crucial to manage national opinion so that the public do not believe that their loyalties are being rolled over. But he says, well, it should be relatively straightforward for political leaders to prevent national pride turning into aggressive xenophobia. But if so, why don't they do it? I mean, who has done it? In theory, it sounds doable. I yearn for it to happen more, but it doesn't happen a lot these days, does it?
Well, I think, frankly, it's a consequence of inadequate political leadership, including from people on the moderate end of politics, either at the moderate end of conservative parties or the moderate end in Britain of Labour parties. I think we've failed to stand up for the principles and values which have actually made our lives much better than the lives of our parents or grandparents. And I think there is a sort of tendency on the part of, to be frank, people like me, not to be as tough and rough in our politics as right-wingers are, as nationalists are. I mean, there is a very important case to make for patriotism. Patriotism isn't the same as nationalism. You don't feel if you're a patriot, you have to sentimentalize your history, glamorize your institutions. You don't feel if you're a patriot that you always need another in order to define yourself against them. Earlier this week, I was very lucky to have lunch with the governor of South Australia and his wife. He's a Vietnamese Australian, Australian-Vietnamese. And he was describing how he'd come by boat to Australia, how he'd been welcomed, not regarded as a threat or a challenge, how he'd made a tremendous life for himself here in Australia, helped by Australian values and Australian friends. And I could think of lots of examples of that happening in Britain. And indeed, that would have been the story which my own great-grandfather would have told in the 19th century, because he was a potato famine Irish immigrant into England. And so I do think that there is a hugely important role for patriotism in our values and in our life. And we haven't argued that sufficiently vigorously against those who have a very narrow idea of nationalism. And maybe all that's been made more difficult by migration in the modern world, by globalization, by social media. Social media, which sometimes allows people to connect simply with other people who share their prejudices.
Well, that's what you're sort of, as you say, you write very eloquently, I think, about identity and the risks that it can take you into territory that denies civic humanism and common decency. It can goad you into belligerence. It can turn victimhood into a way of life. Now, have you seen that, particularly in your work in Yugoslavia and Northern Ireland? I mean, have you seen people consciously sort of pull themselves out of that?
Yeah, I have, but it's not done very easily. I mean, I had one of the jobs which I did, which was probably in some respects the most difficult, and the one one shouldn't say these things, it's rather vain, but the one I'm proudest of was reorganizing the police service and the security services after the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland, taking the police out of the center of politics, redefining the police as upholders of everybody's human rights and civil liberties, not having the police seen as a sort of guardian of a Protestant unionist state, making sure that there were as many Catholics joining the police service as Protestants. All that went right to the heart of an identity politics, which had actually nothing to do with Luther or the Pope or transubstantiation, but everything to do with power being the top dog. And invariably, the way people define a dispute isn't what it's really all about. It was the same in the Balkans. In the Balkans, the Croatians didn't want the Serbs to run a dismembered Yugoslavia. The Serbs didn't want the Croatians to run Croatia. And in the middle were the poor Muslim Bosniaks who were murdered by the thousand, with concentration camps brought back in Europe, with Srebrenica, and all those terrible tragedies because of people's wicked sense of identity.
Well, I mean, last year I was in Ireland for the 100 years since the Easter Rising, because my family came out just before it.
Yeah.
And I spoke to the American writer and foreign correspondent David Reif about his book In Praise of Forgetting, which really resonated with the listeners that people and nations are held back because they place so much emphasis on remembering the traumas of the past. And he was arguing for actually the noble act of forgetting some of them in order to forge a resolution, a reconciliation for the future. What are your views on this?
Well, I think that is partly true, but there was a wonderful Northern Ireland poet called Louis MacNeice, whose father was actually an Anglican bishop. And MacNeice's father, in a famous sermon in Belfast, once said, "We have to remember the past, the better to forget it." I mean, it's terribly important that in Britain, as an ex-colonial power, in order to shape our present relationship with India or our Indian diaspora in the UK, we're honest and open about the way some people saw us behaving in India and the way we did actually behave. So there's just been a wonderful, very polemical book by somebody called Tharoor, a former UN official,
about and Malcolm Gladwell's amazing podcasting on this too.
Absolutely. So it's really important. I mean, I've always regarded history, I've studied history at university, as a sort of insurrectionary subject because it does oblige you to look at the world in a more accurate and clear-sighted way.
This is very pertinent in one of the stories you cite, when you were chair of the Independent Commission on Policing, as you describe it, after the Belfast Agreement, and you went to a public meeting in a small village on the coast called Mourns, I think it is, and you were talking at the meeting about the need for generosity and reconciliation and healing and hope, and a little old lady at the back of the hall said, "It's all very well coming over here and giving us all that stuff about generosity of spirit. You go home after this is over. We have to stay with our histories and experience." For instance, and she leant forward and touched the young man in front of her on the shoulder, "This man here murdered my son."
Yeah. I mean, it was true. He was one of the convicted murderers who'd been let out as a result of the Good Friday Agreement in order to get the IRA to lay down their arms and the paramilitaries on the other side. Sometimes it's easier to preach than it is to actually live with the intimacy of violence in these communities. But that was quite a lesson for me. Another lesson was told by my best Irish friend who lived in Downpatrick, which is a largely Catholic community just south of Belfast. He had a Catholic family moved in next door who'd been burnt out of their home in Belfast. And he one day hears the kids playing in the garden, and one little girl is saying to her brothers and sisters, "It's my turn to be the prod now, the Protestant now." And he leans over the fence and says, "Mary, what do you mean by that?" And she says, "It's my turn to have a go on the swing." From that age, wow. She had a profound sense that her community was the, you know, the second in line, that Protestants were top dogs. Now, I'm extremely ecumenical. I'm married to a member of the Church of England. I used to be described as being somebody who had a mixed marriage by some Northern Ireland journalist, which made me look over my shoulder as though somehow two Martians had got married to some people from Pluto. I mean, it was a very curious sensation. So I really think that it's terribly important for us to look beyond what sometimes is suggested should be the narrow boundaries of our identity. And I think when you look around the world today, and when you look at the extent to which nationalism is undermining, for example, the institutions that we established after the Second World War and which have enabled us to prosper on the whole in peace, it's really important that we reestablish the concept, as one of St. Augustine's protégés said, that among Romans, I'm a Roman. Among Christians, he said, I'm a Christian. Among humans, I'm a human. And, you know, among Australian friends, I'm a little bit Australian. And among Irish immigrants, I'm an Irishman. I mean, it's much more complicated than we often suggest.
So how would you read this move by the Trump administration to move their embassy back to Jerusalem, you know, in terms of the Israel-Palestine identity issues?
Well, I'm afraid one has started to run out of adjectives for President Trump. I think he's a sort of, in this case, it's an example of diplomatic arson. Why has no previous president of the United States gone along with what has become a rather right-wing Israeli objective?
They did vote it in 1994, it turns out, but didn't apply it.
Exactly. Nobody's actually applied it because they know that it's throwing a bomb into any serious attempt to negotiate a peaceful settlement. Not that we've seen much effort by the Israeli government to go along with that in the last few years. I think it's a terrible tragedy, and the longer it's gone on, the more difficult it's going to be to have any sort of two-state solution. What I find especially depressing is my best Israeli friends, and I used to work on this issue when I was European Commissioner for Foreign Affairs, my best Israeli friends like Yossi Beilin, Shlomo Ben-Ami, who were both partly responsible for the attempt to negotiate an agreement at Camp David, have simply been swept off the political stage now, and it's completely dominated by right-wingers. And President Trump has played into their hands. And he's taken a decision which I fear will lead to the loss of life. It's unbelievable how bad he's been.
So, look, before I let you go, it would be remiss of me not to ask you about the rise of China, which you must have discovered since you've been in Australia, is just an extraordinarily important story. And it's increasing control over Hong Kong, with a lot of the offices now being occupied by political apparatchiks. That's the word that we're hearing. But you say that it's not in our interest that China's success should turn into a story of failure, certainly not in Australia's interest. But in your view, it's profoundly unlikely that China is about to rule the world. Why do you say that?
Because I think that what China stands for, and particularly more and more under this president, is Leninism, is hardline dictatorship. I mean, let's not beat about the bush. President Xi Jinping has rode back on some of the consequences of reforms that had been put in train by Deng Xiaoping. I mean, Deng Xiaoping was no sort of lily-livered liberal, but Deng Xiaoping had started a process of opening up, and Xi Jinping has begun and gone along with the process of closing down. And why has he done it? Because he takes, or his advisors, I doubt whether it's something he feels very strongly about. They've taken two bits of advice from a very famous book by the French political philosopher Alexis de Tocqueville, called the Old Regime and the French Revolution. And there are two lessons that apparently his advisors have taken from that. The first is that just because people are getting better off doesn't mean they're going to be easier to govern. They become more aware of social inequities, more aware of unfairness in society, and that has, of course, started to be the case in China. Secondly, that all autocratic regimes, whether it's the Bourbons in France or the Leninists, they're not really communist anymore, in Beijing, they're always at their most vulnerable when they start to reform. So answer, you don't make any changes, you don't reform. I mean, I continue to argue passionately that it's in all our interest that 1.2, 1.3 billion people do well economically.
Does it excite you at all, their rebirth, as it were?
It doesn't excite me. I mean, it's always been the case that sooner or later the largest country in the world would have the largest economy. It has done for 18 out of the last 19 centuries, and it will happen again. But what I don't believe is that the values I believe in, and I'm sure you believe in, of openness, of pluralism, of due process, rule of law, accountability, free speech, all those things, I don't believe that they're going to be flushed down the pan. I think that's what will create a better future. Why is China so corrupt? Because there aren't things like a free media. Why is China facing huge difficulties, actually, in moving towards a more open economy? Because when you do that, the party starts to lose control over the state. So I think that it's very important to have as good relationship with China as possible. I don't believe in trying to, quote, contain China, but I do believe that we inevitably have a different relationship to societies which are democratic than societies which like China today, is Leninist.
Chris Patton, thank you very much indeed for joining us and outlining all those insights.
Thanks very much indeed. Bye now.